And we're recording. How's it going, Jason? Nice to connect with
Good.
you.
Likewise, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
I want to ask you that. How are you? But like, not just in the polite way where you say good, how are you? I started this recently, at least. I'm probably gonna stop doing it at a certain point with the guest. I start by asking them how are they given the recent crazy world we've been in. I remember the Basecamp Hair on Fire visual that used to be on the website. Basecamp help you with that, help you organize stuff, but whether we liked it or not, everybody's hair was on fire up to a degree because of COVID and everything that happened in the world. So really now, how are you in this world?
Yeah, I'm doing, as good as can be expected. We're healthy, family's healthy, doing all right, to be honest, doing all right. I mean, last year was a big unknown for everybody. It still remains to be. There's a lot of unknowns left, I suppose, with new variants and whatnot, but I'm feeling good. I'm happy.
How's what's happening in the world of Jason Fried these days?
The world. I've got two young kids, so that's like most of my world. I'm a parent. My wife and I are, parenting, and it's a lot of work. And then, of course, with work, I'm doing work. We're working on a new version of Basecamp right now, working on some new stuff for Hey, working on hiring a bunch of people, working on hiring some key roles. And so there's a lot of stuff going on, but nothing feels overwhelming. It just feels like, a good time to pay attention to decisions.
So two full-time jobs, parenting and then Basecamp the company.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to
Yes.
find that out myself. I don't have any kids, but
You
eventually I
will one
plan
day.
to. Yeah. And
You'll find out.
I'll sign up for that job as well when the
Yeah.
time comes. Interesting. So Basecamp 4 is in the making. I myself am a Basecamp user, so I'm pretty excited about that. Not that Basecamp 3 isn't doing its job, quite the contrary. Yeah, how's Basecamp 4 going? How excited are you about that?
Well, really good. So we're kind of roll Basecamp 4 out differently than we have with previous versions. So previous versions, we did brand new versions. So there's Basecamp Classic or the original version. Then we came out with 2, and Classic stayed around, and 2 was available. And then when we came out with 3, 2 stayed around, and Classic stayed around, and 3 was available. With 4, we're actually going to be morphing version 3 into version 4. So everyone who uses 3 will get 4. And we're doing this in a really careful way as not to sort of upset the apple cart. Sometimes when you make big changes to software, people want the old one back, essentially, because they're used to that. So we're doing this in a very careful, measured way. We're going to be rolling features out over a series of months, over many, many months, rather than one big bang release. This will allow people to adapt to some of the changes. We're also keeping the interface mostly the same. We're improving in a variety of ways, but it's going to feel familiar. It's going to feel like fresh, but familiar. So I'm really excited about the product and where we're going with it, and how we're doing it this time. We're doing it differently. So that'll be really fun. We're going to begin to be rolling out some stuff pretty shortly, in fact. Starting with some basic, simple stuff, but then we're going to be rolling into some more of the really interesting changes that are coming down the road.
I know you've mentioned before in one of the Twitter Q&As, ask hashtag ask JF, you've mentioned something that's struck me as really interesting. You mentioned that you were paying close attention to the copywriting of the buttons or the copywriting generally, and that this was one of the major directions of Basecamp 4, where you were given an example of you don't just assign somebody something to somebody. That's not how it happens in real life. So is it too early to ask you to give us a bit more about that? Because I found that avenue really interesting.
It is too early because this is just some of our thinking, right? I'm not sure where these ideas are going to manifest themselves in the product, but essentially what we're trying to think about is, with software is this typically this very technical thing. It's a very binary thing. It's like words are, for example, when you're invited to an event in Google Calendar, or not in Google Calendar, in calendaring systems, the options are usually accept or what, reject or something like that, right? It's like, I think those are the two things. Or deny or decline or something like, yeah, decline or something. It's like, these are pretty harsh words. Like, think about what it's like to decline somebody versus saying like, actually, I just can't make it, or can we try another time? Or, this just doesn't work for my schedule. Like when humans talk to each other, it's a very conversational exchange. When computers talk to people and people talk to computers, well, oftentimes people are only given options to respond based on what the computer gives you. And when software is made, it's often this like very binary, you know, accept, decline, reject, whatever. And we're trying to just soften the language a bit, so it feels a little more comfortable and more realistic. For example, sometimes you do have to assign work to people. Like that is something that happens. But other times you're actually asking people, can they do something? Well, the language of software is often like assign or assign to or delegate to versus like, what about ask if, you know? Now, again, I don't know how that's going to manifest exactly in the product, but this is the mindset that we're in. You know, can you ask someone for something versus tell someone to do something? In some cases you do tell, in most cases you ask. If you're talking to a peer, you're asking. If it's maybe more of a manager to someone who's doing the work situation, it might be an assignment. There are different ways to do these things, but software kind of only gives you one way usually. And so we're just thinking this through. I don't know, again, don't know how it will show up, but.
But you have a bit of a natural progression, because even today in Basecamp, some cancel, quote unquote, buttons are, no, never mind. And right. So I see how that's already inside. I suppose it's just something you want to go deeper on in this new version of Basecamp, pretty much.
Yeah, we've always been thinking this way. We're just trying to extend that thinking. So yeah, we use the word never mind oftentimes instead of cancel. Or not now is another thing we'll say versus like no, something like that, you know? So I think we're just continuing down that path of how can we talk with people versus give them options that are so black and white. You know, even though the button will do the same thing, it just feels better saying, never mind, which is basically, I didn't mean to do that, or I don't want to do that, versus cancel is just such a strong, definitive no, which is not really what it calls for in most situations. It's just like, never mind. So, yeah.
That makes sense. But I want to try to people, I don't know if you're aware of this one, but to people from the outside, across the years with the different articles you've written or your philosophy, even in the books, you struck me as a person who has some sort of zen in a world that's very busy. And I think a lot of people appreciate that because, I mean, take Rework or any of the books. You've had some points of view that said, oh, no, it doesn't have to be like that. It doesn't have to be crazy at work, for instance. See all the, like even the cover, all the crosstown things. So do you think about where does that come from? Does it come natural to you? Has it been something cultivated?
It's probably it's definitely evolved, I would say. But I remember back in the earlier days of when I was doing website design, I was always focused on the writing. I don't know why. I just like writing. I didn't like writing in school, actually, but I like writing professionally. And I just always remember like wondering why things were just called what they were called. Why was this a cancel button? You know, that was sort of something that came from the Mac, I think, originally, something like that, you know, maybe it was even before that. But, and then you just sort of, people just follow that path. They just take it for granted. They just keep doing the same thing. And I've always just tried to at least wonder why. Why this? Why not something else? If this other thing makes more sense, why not do that? And also just think about when I see buttons, like how do I feel about them? How do I react to them? Yeah, look, I don't really care if it says cancel. It's not like it's the end of the world, but like, isn't there a better word than that? You know, whenever I write, I'm always like, isn't there a better word? Whatever I write, I'm like, isn't there a better way to say that? Isn't there a better way, a better word for that word, or a better way to start a sentence, or a better way to end a sentence? I'm just always wondering, is there a better way to say that? And I think there are many better ways to say things that computers say today. Now, of course, computers don't, people program the computers, and people who are programming the computers say these things and the computer just presents it to you. But there's got to be better ways to say a lot of things. And so that's something we've always been thinking about. And it has been an evolution though, for sure.
And I've learned that from you with or without your permission. You had a video where at one point in one of the articles you're writing for Inc., you made a video on YouTube where you open up IA Writer and you just typed it out.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
I think it was for Shape Up, or no? I might be mixing them up.
It was just some blog post I think I was writing, and I'm like, might as well write this live.
Yeah. And you had this thing which I got from you indirectly of at every now and then you stop and say, "No, that's not what I want to say," or "Is there a better way to say this?" And you sectioned that, which I really appreciated. I got it indirectly. I found myself doing that, and then I circle back. Oh, it was this video from Jason. He did that. Okay, that's nice. So I understand that. But leave copywriting aside. There's no better word I can find besides spirituality, even though that's not a good descriptor. You're Zen, I guess. B besides copywriting, generally, even with your approach in some of the answers you give on Twitter in the videos, or you sometimes just ask, why does it have to be like this? Like, why do you assume it has to be this way? Is that something you practice in terms of you think, okay, let me try and simplify it, or is it just your experience with life? Do you not have an answer for this? Because I guess that's an answer as well.
I do think I probably generally approach things that way. You know, why does it have to be this way? I think we've built a business that's different than many other businesses because I didn't really understand the way it was supposed to be. Why can't it be this other way? I don't know where that came from. Maybe somewhere in my upbringing, you know, my parents encouraged me to think those ways. Maybe I was exposed to someone who thought that way and I thought it was interesting. I think it probably all comes down to the idea of editing. Like I like to edit, so I like when I write, I'm editing what I'm writing as I'm writing. When I look at a button, I copyright, I edit te the text as if it was a book, but it's a one-word book. It's just a button, you know. If I'm looking at the rules, whatever the rules are, like can I edit those to make more sense? You know, I don't know. I don't know where it comes from, but it is something I try to consider with whatever it is I'm doing. Is there a different way? Is there a better way? Like, why is it this way? It's also maybe just a curiosity. Like, it starts there. Like, why is it this way? And oh, okay, it's that way because of that. Well, what if it was a different way? Like, what would that mean? And I just find it kind of playful, to be honest. It's just a, it makes everything a little bit more interesting, I think, when you just wonder more about it than just take it for given. Now, of course, you don't want to like paralyze yourself by constantly asking why and never getting anywhere. Some things just don't matter either way, and you just kind of roll with them. But when things are of consequence, I tend to try to wonder why.
So then, do you have any insight why most people are in such a either a hurry or it has to be perfect? Whereas what I get from you is it's more of a give and take, it's more of a dance rather than a there's a certain way. So time and time again, I mean, I'm sure you fail with some things, but time and time again you found some different ways of doing stuff.
Yeah. Why do people, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know. I think everyone's just has a different approach. Some people have, it's just like some people really like wine and can taste all the different flavors of, you know, all the different flavors or flavor profiles in a glass of wine. And they obsess over it, whether or not this is more like, you know, I'm not going to get into it because I'm not a wine drinker. So, but you can hear people like go, and for me, I just doesn't, it doesn't matter. Like, I just don't care. If it's like, if I like the flavor, it's fine. Like for me, like that's how I think. But for other people, that is a huge world for them. And so, you know, in my case, I like this kind of thinking about problems and solutions, and to other people may not be a big deal, just like wine isn't a big deal to me. And the things I focus on may not be a big deal to them. I think everyone has their own thing. I don't think whatever, I don't think anything is right or wrong about it. It's just a different approach. And hey, if our buttons were called cancel, may not matter at all. Maybe like you may not gain an extra customer or lose a customer. May not, none of this stuff may actually matter, but it matters to me. And I enjoy doing it. I enjoy thinking it through. And that's why we do what we do is, you know, it matters to us. And that's reason enough to go down those paths, I think.
I ask these sort of questions that I've just asked you to people who have either a different way of doing things, which is interesting, or a certain mindset, bit of a buzzword. I mean, old buzzword. So that's why. And some people rationalize it and have a clear explanation of, oh, I used to be like this and then I became that. But I know that some other people don't rationalize it at all. A bit like you. That's what I get from you. You don't think that much about it. So that's why it's interesting to hear the balance. But anyway, leave that aside. What's something that in this period of time you are trying to get better at? What's something you need to get better at in this?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things. Patience, tolerance, not jumping to conclusions. I think those are especially important things, especially with parenting. And sort of seeing things through other people's eyes a bit better. Those are things that are things I'm working on. Also working on letting go a bit more. I've been running this business for 22 years, and one realization I've had recently is like, we've built an amazing business. The business is great. The company, I think it's a great company, but it's nowhere near what it should be in terms of the company part of it. Like, it's too reliant on a few people. It's not resilient enough if, like, it's just David and I make all the final decisions. Like, there's some things we want to do with some groups we don't have. There's some leadership we could probably use. And I want to, like, build the build the company out to be a stronger company. So, like, right now I feel like we're holding on to the steering wheel, and if we let go, it might sort of careen off perhaps, because there's no one else to maybe grab it. But what I want to do is I want to be in this place where I can just kind of let it go, and it just keeps going on its own. And you kind of have a pride in that we've built something that is a lot, that there's more drivers perhaps. So we have this incredible team here. And we always have had an incredible team. We're very careful about who we hire and how we hire, but I don't think we've really built up a dedicated sort of senior leadership layer. Everyone is sort of promoted up through, which has been wonderful, and everyone's great, but like, we haven't brought people in from the outside with executive management experience, which I think would be pretty handy and pretty helpful for the company. So there's some things I'm thinking about there, meaning like, I need to let go a little bit and have some other people come in and do some stuff. And so I don't know, those are some of the things I'm thinking about and working on. I think mostly though, it's on the life side of things that I'm trying to improve, because I think that improves all things.
So you've mentioned patience. I got everything you said on the company and business side. Very interesting. You mentioned patience on the personal side, and you might have mentioned it just in the realm of parenting, but at the same time, you struck me as somebody who is patient, or at least on the business side, where people are in a hurry. We got this KPI, and you said, no, it's not really like that. Or a moment where I said, whoa, okay, what's happening here, was when you said, yeah, our business might be destroyed. Maybe with the Apple thing, with Hey, maybe before, because project management was getting revolutionized by this and that company. Isn't that patience, or are we not using the same?
No, we are. I am pretty patient in terms of sort of the big picture. It's more in the moment stuff. And it's mostly around like kids, it's mostly around that. In big picture, yeah, I am pretty patient. I think, I'd like to let things unfold and see where they go versus, clamp down on something too early, that kind of thing. But in general, just kind of letting that happen in life too, I think, is something that that I need to work on a little bit. And then there's, certain, I become irritable when like, I see the path and it's not going in the right direction, and like, maybe it's going to end up turning in the right direction, but right now it's not. And so I get a bit, irritated about that. And I kind of just want to personally improve on that a little bit. But yeah, these are things I think most people are also trying to work on for themselves too. So I think it's a pretty common thing to deal with.
Yeah, I'll admit I cheated a bit, because I've asked you this question of what you need to get better at, because I found a tweet of yours saying, this is, I don't know what you said, but I said, okay, I need to ask him that.
Yeah. And
part of my research as well on you was this, because I was trying to figure out how to ask great questions. I feel like a conversation is a bit of a dance. What you were saying earlier, same way as machine human, but also human to human, where conversation is the space in which great answers can come. Do you have any suggestion, maybe from your experience, maybe from the last 22 minutes, maybe from other podcasts, as to how to ask great questions or how to facilitate great answers?
I think the great questions are usually the follow-up questions. So when you ask something and then someone says something and then you go, let's go deeper on that thing. I think that's often where the really interesting stuff lies. And I think sometimes with interviews, someone has a set of questions and they just kind of go through them and they don't deviate and they don't ask about the answer that was just given. They just move on to their next question. So it's not so much how to ask good ones. It's more when to ask questions and spot that there's something deeper here. And then, you know, the question might be, tell me more. Like, it's not like, or can you tell me more? It's not even like a brilliant question. It's just, it's a moment. Ah, there's something else here. Let's go deeper. Or what do you mean by that? Is another great question to ask. So simple, but what do you mean by that? And I often find that when you ask that question, the second answer you get, so you ask that in response to an answer that you just got, the next thing the person says is often the really interesting thing. So it's those kind of techniques more so than like having a brilliant question queued up that I think is where you find the really interesting stuff in interviews.
How do you find that out? Do you ever interview people? Or, I mean, I guess you do for jobs, but not in a podcast or something. Have you ever done that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This is one of those things. This might have been that tweet. Like, I want to get better at interviewing people. I'm not great at it. I think it's a wonderful skill. If you're a really good interviewer, it's a wonderful, wonderful skill to have. I learned some of this from just watching and listening to other great interviewers. I think Howard Stern is a great example. Howard Stern is, I think, probably one of the world's best interviewers. Oprah is also an incredibly good interviewer. And a lot of them just, and you know, there's others too, but they'll say like, you know, why? Or tell me more about that. Or what do you mean by that? Or they'll be list, they're active listeners. They don't just have a list of things. They're listening. And then they go deeper on certain things and they can tell where the energy is. And I really love listening to interviews. So I pick up on that. I also learned a little bit about this from sort of a mentor friend of mine, a guy named Bob Mesta, who does these interviews. He interviews people around this framework called Jobs to be Done, which is a customer research. I don't know what he would call it or how to phrase it, but it's a way of gaining insights from customers, in a sense, or people. And he'll often, in these interviews, and I've sat with him during these interviews, someone will give an answer and Bob will go, I don't understand. Like, what do you mean? And the person will just add this additional layer of information and clarity, which brings a whole new light to the picture. And he might say again, like, so what you're saying is, and then he'll try to repeat something. And then I go, no, that's not what I meant. I meant this. And then you really start to get very specific. And so I've watched that technique. I've also read a book by Chris Voss, who is a former FBI investigator or
negotiator.
Negotiator, yeah. And he has some wonderful techniques around mirroring and labeling and stuff, where you can really kind of let the other person say a lot more than they intended to say. So it's not about tricking them. It's just about like creating an opening for them to speak more. So I've just enjoyed listening to interviews where the interviewer is actually curious enough to listen and then to ask follow-ups in this style. I find those to be the best kinds. Joe Rogan's great at this too. He's really especially good at this. Anyway.
I'll try and see if I can implement any of them by the end of this. Hopefully I will. We'll see. I'll try and analyze myself. Another thing I found interesting while researching you was, I mean, it was right under my nose because it was in the AMA you've done on the subreddit, on Reddit SaaS. You said what happens on Twitter is not a reflection of what actually happens. I was like, oh, yeah. Is that sort of thing where Twitter is a bubble, or maybe even the tech space is a bubble. And I'm gonna cheat. Could you tell us more about that? What happens on Twitter?
Yeah. Twitter is this thing that when you're sort of paying attention to it all the time, it becomes the landscape, it becomes the sky, it becomes everything. Like, it's, you think that that's the world, that these opinions are held broadly, that that if there's enough noise, it means everybody thinks the same thing, that if people like something, then it's likable. If people don't like something, then it's terrible. Like, but really, it's just like the smallest sliver. It's opinions, and they're valid or whatever. They're as valid or invalid as anything else. But it's the public nature of it, and the enveloping nature of it, and the quantity of it, and the ease in which people can comment on things that makes you think, well, these opinions are everyone's opinions. And it's not. It's like, it's a small sliver of things, and it might be a vocal sliver and a powerful sliver, but it doesn't represent, necessarily what everybody thinks about something. So that's all. It's just, and especially the other thing about Twitter and algorithmic, Twitter's less about this than others, but algorithmic timelines is that, they're showing you things that are either going to outrage you or you're going to totally agree with. It's like these worlds are also manufactured worlds, and they're self-reinforcing worlds. And it's not hard to think that everyone thinks this way when everything you see is that, either reinforces or pushes against. It's just like, you think that's what everything is because, gosh, Facebook and Twitter and these things are huge. And of course they must be everybody, but no, these systems are showing you the things that really they think are going to lead to more engagement and the whole thing. And so anyway, that's, I think that's sort of just the reality. And I think, we saw this a little bit with what happened here in April, where we made some policy changes and around political conversations inside Basecamp, and Twitter threw a whole lot of hate at us. But when I speak to people outside of Twitter, people are like, that seemed like a pretty reasonable decision, actually. I don't talk about politics at work. I wouldn't think that would be a good thing to do. And we don't do that where I work. And I think it makes sense. And, but then you get into Twitter world and it's just like, everyone's just throwing insults and hate and like the worst kind of hate. And there's grandstanding because everyone gets to watch you hate on someone else. And there's all these things that are playing into the human, human condition. But if you actually have a conversation with somebody on the outside, most people are actually pretty reasonable. But on Twitter, it's not actually a conversation. It's mudslinging and flinging and grandstanding. So it's not a conversation. Two humans aren't meeting in a discussion. And that's kind of the other point of this, is that, people you might disagree with strongly on Twitter, or people who disagree strongly with you on Twitter, the way they communicate that disagreement on Twitter is very different than the way they would communicate it if you were just sitting across a table having lunch. And that's the other thing that's not real about Twitter. Twitter is not really how people talk to each other. And I think that's an important thing to remember too, that people aren't actually that spiteful and that hateful and that divisive in person.
This thing you've mentioned earlier of the algorithm it's up to a degree factual, and I'm on the same page with this, where the algorithm is meant to outrage you. Where do you stand on that in terms of, do you think it was, 'cause some people believe it was made with malevolence, some other people, a bit of a less loud voice, but more sound to me, I'm showing my opinion now, say, don't assume malevolence where you could assume stupidity, or the second part is, don't assume malevolence where you could assume a business incentive. So where do you stand out? Do you think this sort of algorithm that pushes towards outrageousness sucks you in? Do you think it was, first of all, do you think it was manual, or did it just, the algorithm sort itself out into whatever it was that would have gotten the most engagement, and it just happened that outrageousness was that?
I think, let's just take Twitter, for example, and Facebook even. Like, they didn't start this way. They didn't start this way. I mean, like, they became this way. And whether or not it's malevolent, intentionally damaging, I think it's sort of become that now. But I don't think that was the intention, no. And I'm not even sure the first few steps towards it were that. But it's similar to, like, you could think about this in terms of evolution in a sense. Like, you know, before something grew wings, it actually didn't just have no wings and then have wings. It grew a tiny little nub first. And that nub had to be beneficial to continue down the lineage and be passed on. And that nub became a bigger nub and maybe a flatter nub and all these different things. Like, the wing didn't just happen. We look at things and go, oh, it grew a wing. Well, it didn't just go from no wing to a wing. So all the things along the way had to lead there. And they didn't necessarily know where they were going. It wasn't that this nub knew it would be a wing. It eventually became that. I think that's what happens here. And then when you realize how powerful a wing is, in this case, how powerful, you know, hate and argument and, you know, controversy is, well, then you just keep going in that direction because you realize, like, what it's giving you. And what it's giving these companies is engagement. And engagement leads to money because that's what their business model is. And very few things are as appealing and as engaging as seeing people sling mud at each other or to feed into ideas that you believe to be true and self-reinforce or reinforce, not self-reinforce, but that reinforce your own current beliefs. Incredibly powerful. There's nothing that feels better than hearing from someone else that you're right. I mean, that's a pretty powerful thing. So I think these systems now do this intentionally. They weren't intended initially to do that. But once they saw how powerful they were, that's where they went.
Do you ever think that it also reflects this other argument that it reflects on us as a human species, where not that nihilistic point of view of, oh, we're actually looking for it. But if I put it this way, you know, speak about evolution. If when we were evolving, we weren't sensitive to negative news, Jaguar comes, eat you, or, you know, you get hurt, that sort of thing. So maybe those little seeds, this little nubs, become now a wing within us where we're looking at the algorithm and the algorithm points back at us. What's your opinion on that spectrum?
I'm not sure I have an opinion on that. I'm not sure it'd be any different than the one I just shared. Maybe I didn't understand the question perhaps then. Can you?
I would say, so you could also say that the algorithm is basically just pointing back at us. What do I mean by that? It's because we have, for thousands of years, we have developed this ultra sensitiveness to negative news because you're in the jungle, for instance, and something flies at you, you better spread it to the tribe. That's deeply ingrained within us.
Yes.
And in the last 100 years, maybe those risks have been diminished, but you can't negotiate with thousands and thousands of years or maybe more. So that's an example of a quote unquote relatively interpretable bad trace from the past. So because we have that, it's now reflected in the algorithm. That's a point of view, as opposed to Facebook is evil and Mark Zuckerberg and this and that, you know, that extreme argument or somewhere in between.
Well, I guess there's a lot of different ways to piece that one out. I mean, there's bits about privacy and personal information and using that information against people, like, against their will, without their knowledge. Like, there is some evil, I believe, in that sort of thing. It's almost like taking advantage of the worst of human nature, and those are conscious decisions. The algorithm is not written by computers. It's humans write this thing. There's direction on what to do and what to take advantage of, and they know what works and what doesn't. So these are conscious decisions. I do agree that the internet, in many ways, is just a great example of, you know, some things maybe just don't work at scale. I mean, they work, but like they're not better. You know, like. Connecting, David, my business partner, has been talking a bit about this, and I've been thinking a little bit more about it, which is that maybe connecting a billion people is not actually a good thing. Like, maybe more connections between people is not a good thing. Now, you could argue that, like, And Zuckerberg's argument is that like the world's a connected world is a better world. Like that's fundamentally like what his argument that's kind right. of has been. And I'm not so sure that that's the case actually. So I don't know what the answer is, but you can see how it got to this point and how it will probably continue, but I'm not sure it's actually a good thing for the world. I think it might be a net negative ultimately. I don't know though, but I do think it does, to your point, like it does reflect who we are, but it also takes advantage of maybe things that maybe used to be true, but aren't necessarily as true anymore. Like we don't have to fear the lion coming out of the bush anymore, you know, that kind of thing. Like, but those things are still in our lizard brain basically. So like, you know, take advantage of that. It's pretty powerful. It feels like taking advantage of versus like should be doing. These are difficult decisions. There's a lot of factors. You've got these are public companies. You've got public markets that are demanding growth. Like there's a lot of things. This is actually becomes very, very complicated. And it becomes extremely uncomplicated to unwind. It may be impossible to unwind any of these things. Like we may not be able to go back from where we are. But I don't know. These are interesting discussions to have. I don't really have any definitive answers, but that's sort of what comes to mind when you ask the question.
That's fine. Speaking of David, do you guys have like a regular call? Is it all impromptu? Because, okay, I know you've been remote for all this time, but I also know you guys are in different cities, Chicago and LA, or wherever that is. Do you guys have a schedule thing or is it always just chatting randomly? Because, a bit of a personal question maybe. Are you friends outside of work?
Yeah, good question. So random. Definitely random conversations. We don't have a scheduled, never have ever had a scheduled, like let's catch up every Tuesday morning or anything like that. So it's just random when things need to be discussed or when we show each other something or make a decision together or whatever. That's how that works. I think we're friendly for sure. I mean, we're friends. We don't hang out like because we're not in the same city, first of all. And even if we were, I don't think we would hang out that much. You know, they've come over to our house, we've gone over to their house, you know, we both have kids, there's some of that, but also like one of the things that becomes really hard when you have kids is just hanging out at all. Like, you know, schedules are what they are. And, you know, it's very hard to find any free time to literally hang out with anybody anymore. You know, you got to line up babysitters if you want to get, it's all these things become really hard. So I don't really hang out with anybody. I think we're absolutely good friends and have known each other for a long time and know each other better than, you know, most people probably know each other. So, yes, but yeah, random discussions. We're talking more frequently these days because we're in the process of hiring a COO. And so we're doing a lot of interviews and a lot of discussions about the candidates and that sort of thing. So that's something that's pretty common these days, but normally just talk when we need to.
I can say I understand that bit with kids but I generally can't because it's an experience you only get to when you have it. I can understand that I can't understand it. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I hear from all parents is that I've heard.
You have no time.
I heard this thing of you think project management is bad. Just wait until you have kids. Good luck with that. It's like an add-on.
And they're wonderful, but it's just basically there's no time. You lose your free time. You don't have much free, if you're an involved parent, like you just don't have any free time, which is part of the deal. I'm not bitter because of it. Just like, it's just the reality.
Facts.
So there's not a lot of friend hanging out these days.
Speaking of young people, so to speak, what does it mean to you? I've had this question myself. That's why I put it down on my screen here. What does it mean to you when people get inspired by you? I mean, you on a personal, but also you on a collective level as a company. So, and I mean, in all the ways, youngsters learn from you by example, or people are getting inspired by the design. So after hey.com, I've seen instances where this design language has been not copied in the sense of clone, but you know, people are getting inspiration, or that multi-select boom, pop-up thing where, kind of existed before, but I did spot hey.com in some other products. Does it mean anything to you in the first place?
No, I don't know. I mean, it's nice to push an industry perhaps in a certain way or have an influence. I think it's nice to have an influence, but I don't look for it. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it. In terms of like, I'm not really someone who likes taking credit for things like that. I'm just like a bit uncomfortable with that notion. But it's cool. I mean, I think it means that some people like what we're doing. And, you know, I was really inspired by Nike when I you know, love Nike. And, when I was younger, especially, and their design language and their advertising really spoke to me and inspired me, not like in a way where I directly used their style because their style was their own, but it gave me a confidence and an energy like to do different things, you know? So I think we're all inspired by all sorts of things. And if someone takes inspiration away from the things we're doing, then I'm glad that our stuff's available to create that inspiration. And you know, over the years, like Basecamp, our websites, our UI designs have been copied time and time and time and time and time again. And, you know, initially it actually would bother me. And then I just got over it because like, what are you going to do? Like, but it also means that people like what we're doing. That's actually kind of good. So I don't know. That's my general feel on it. I don't think though it's healthy to copy. Copying is not healthy. Being inspired by something is, but copying is not, because then you don't understand the reasons why. So if you copy someone's interface design, like where are you going to go from there? Like what do you do when you then have a new idea? How do you apply that if you can't bring a direct analog over from something else? So I do think it's nice to be inspired by and to see things and to wonder and to go, that's really cool. That's neat. Makes me think about something differently. But I don't think it's necessarily a good thing at all to copy. It can be useful as a learning tool to dissect and rebuild. I would do that when I was first getting started in the web design world. I would look at a website and like view source and try to rebuild it just to like understand how to make it, how it comes together. But I wouldn't use that then as my thing. It was just an exercise. So I think it's helpful as an exercise, but not useful professionally to copy other people's work.
So wait, this exercise you're talking about, is it in the sense of walking through the steps of the person who designed or who made that thing just to understand what they've been through, that sort of exercise?
No, you can't really learn what's in someone's head from that, but you can. It's more about how can I recreate this? So if I'm practicing, it's like I play a little bit of guitar and I don't write my own original songs. Like, I don't know how to do that. Hang on, give me 1 second. This phone is ringing. This might be the person. Okay, give me 1 second. Cool.
So one thing you said earlier, which I think was really interesting, was you were talking about inspiration. You said it gives you energy and you said something else. So is that how you define inspiration? Or let me just ask you, what does inspiration mean to you?
Yeah.
How does it feel?
There's a certain degree of like excitement and energy and respect for the thing, like being impressed. Like, that's incredible. Like, who made that? How'd they make that? Or this music is amazing. Like, and you think about like how hard it was to do that and the talent and the practice that went into getting to the place where someone could play like that. Or sometimes it's just a really clever solution to something. It could be a little tiny thing. It doesn't even matter like what it is. Just like, that's clever. It's a clever solution to that problem. That's the kind of stuff that I like, that inspires me, are typically clever solutions, where beauty is applied when it normally wouldn't be, like little flourishes, little extra bits of something that are beautiful, and you can tell that whoever made it cared about it. Landscape design. I love landscape design. I love watches. There's a bunch of things like that inspire me because of their creativity or their mechanical precision or the invention of the thing itself. I don't know. It's a bunch of things, but it's definitely a feeling. It's not a fact. It's like a feeling of, that's really clever. I should, you know, I wish I could do something like that, or I should, you know, whatever it is that I'm doing, can I bring some of those ideas into it? Like, for example, sometimes I'll see color combinations in nature and just be like, that's an inspiring color. I never considered those two colors together. That works really, really well together. And that might make its way into our product somewhere, somehow, you know, that kind of stuff too. We're like, or a shade of something like that's, or a texture of something. That's really a nice texture. I like that texture. I don't know where that might fit, but Now it's in my head. So that's kind of these things that stick are the things that I think are inspirational.
I know you said that before at one point that you can get, or you were saying that you got inspired by nature. I was like, oh, wow, wait, hold on. You can do that in product, just like the Renaissance? Like, wow, I didn't know that. And then I said, okay, I'll see if at a certain point something just makes that connection in my head. By the way, when you said 12, I don't know what the time is for you right now.
Oh, I'm sorry. 10 more minutes-ish, but we can maybe go a little bit longer so no one else shows up.
Cool. So I was going to touch upon watches as well because I mentioned that.
Yep.
So I've asked you because you mentioned before, like in your world.hey.com, which I get from my email, you were saying at one point about the machine that's the phone that's on your wrist and then in your pocket. But then I asked you in the AMA, what's the ratio between Apple Watch to timepiece? And you said you don't wear the Apple Watch that much these days.
How come? I don't really. It's not a good watch. And like, that's all I want is a watch that tells the time. I mean, it's a good watch and that it's accurate and all that stuff. But I know the current version has an always on version, but my previous versions that I had, you had to kind of raise it. So you can't peer at it and look at it. And I don't want the notifications. I don't need any of that stuff. I don't want that stuff near me. You know, I think I did use it for a while for running, you know, just like to track distance or whatever, but then I kind of like, why am I even doing that? Like, why do I need to track my distance? Like, how was the run? Did I enjoy the run? Do I feel like I ran far enough? That's the question that matters. Not like, did I run 1.62 miles or like, was my pace, you know, 7.5 minutes versus 7 minutes and 42 seconds. Like, I don't even care. Like if I was training for a race or the Olympics or okay, but I'm not, I'm just recreationally doing these things. So I just tried not to worry about them. So I think the product is incredibly impressive. I think the Apple Watch is extremely impressive. It feels really like a health device more than anything else ultimately. And I think they're going to have, I mean, they already have had great success, but they're going to have continued success. It's going to become a thing at some point where people feel like they can't live without, especially as it can track more health related components, metrics like blood pressure at some point. And I don't know if it does blood oxygen levels yet, but you know, that'll come. And then insurance companies will maybe give you a discount if you wear it. And like, you can see how it's more of a medical device that happens to tell the time. I just like having the time on me. I don't like these other things at the moment. So for me, a mechanical watch is kind of where it's at for me.
I know
that. Or a G-Shock or something, you know, like just something that's simpler.
Or a Casio. I think you like that as well. Any Casio. You've had that chat publicly with David.
Yeah.
I don't think you remember, but I've asked you at one point about Tudor watches. Because in one of your video replies.
Yes, I remember.
Even people were saying, wow, his face lit up when he talked about watches. So yeah, I'm glad. Yeah. You said you have the Black Bay. What do you think of the new one, the ceramic, the black one?
Bay 58 ceramic or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I like black ceramic watches. I have an IWC black ceramic pilot's watch, which I really like.
That's nice.
I don't like the Black Bay ceramic as much as the standard 58 steel, because I feel like that watch, to me, the little touches of color, a tiny bit of gold in the numbers, that gives it a sense of energy and sort of spirit in a watch that's that size and that's that purpose. The all blacked out, it's super black. It's just like all black. For whatever reason, on that watch, it's not as much of a favorite of mine. All that said, I like the bronze one they came out with recently. I really like bronze as a metal. I like the character it takes on over time. I like how it ages. Now, here's the thing: I like black ceramic on the IWC. I like black ceramic on the in Audemars Piguet and their Royal Oak line when they do that. Like, those are amazing things too. But for whatever reason, the Tudor Black Bay black ceramic doesn't really do it for me. Although I've not seen one in person, so maybe I would change my mind if I saw it. But I don't know.
But do you associate brands with, I don't want to say mood, but like personalities? Because to me, when I look at a Tudor, I know it's going to not have any precious materials, but at the same time, it's going to be well made. Yeah. So no flashy, like people used to call it the younger brother of Rolex, but I feel like it's got its own personality now in the last few years, at least. Do you have that thing?
Yeah. Yeah. I think Tudor is the more, adventurous version of Rolex. It seems like Rolex tries a lot of things with Tudor, and they own Tudor basically. So like they, you know, things that they wouldn't normally do themselves, they'll do there first, which is kind of fun. So I think that that's a young, fun brand. I mean, it's not a young brand technically, but like, it feels like it has a lot of youth in it, while Rolex feels a bit more mature, perhaps. I'll tell you, Rolex as a brand, as a company, it's probably my favorite brand, actually.
Wow.
Because it stands for such excellence. Like, people who don't really know watches, you know, they might think Rolex is like a, you know, fancy watch or like a status symbol or whatever. And I think it can be those things, but their product is so, so good. It's better than pretty much any other product there is at the thing that it does. It's so well engineered. They're so durable. They're so accurate. They're so well made. There are very few products like that. I think there's like Leica cameras are similar in that way. It'll last forever. Like literally it'll last forever. How many things are made today that last forever? Very few things that are mechanical, especially, are really built to that degree. So I have a lot of respect for them and what they're all about. Tudor's great. I think all brands, all brands have their thing. You know, AP has its thing, and I happen to really like A Lange & Söhne, so a German brand. Absolutely love their stuff. I think to me they make the best watches in the world that are sort of mass produced in a sense. They only make, I think, like maybe 10,000 watches a year, so they're not like mass produced like Rolex makes a million. But for any largish brand that makes thousands of watches a year, I don't think anyone can touch Lange. They're just the best.
So what do you have on your wrist right now? Because you've briefly shown it before. The screen.
Well, I happen to have a Lange on. So this is one of my favorite watches. This is the Zeitwerk, which is a digital mechanical watch. So hang on a second. We have to wait 30 seconds, and then you'll see it switch. But here's the
skeleton,
the movement, the little machine right in the back that nice. Most people don't know is actually how these things work. There's no batteries, you know. But here, I'll show you in a second.
You can see the little kind of pipe towards the crown, or no, it's not that.
I'm not sure. Yeah. It's hard to see because I'm looking at it backwards through the camera.
Oh yeah.
But here, so it's 1158, and you're going to see. Now, of course, this is not a big deal in general, but on a mechanical watch, it's really a big deal. So watch here, watch the 58.
Let's see. Nice.
So it just flips to 59, right? So normally it'd be like big deal. Watches do that all the time, but mechanical watches don't. Yeah. It's a pretty big deal. So this is an example of a watch. One of the reasons I like it is because it's so different from anything that ever existed before. There's been jumping hour watches and watches that have sort of a similar kind of thing, but not really, not this way. And it's their watches are just so well made, and everything is just so well finished. And this is such an iconic, original, out of left field, strange thing that the brand did. And I like when brands do things that are unexpected. And this was about as unexpected as you could get, actually, from a brand like Lange. So that's one of my favorite things about it, besides the way I think it just looks great. And it's an amazing thing. Here, it's about to go to 12. So you'll see all the numbers.
That's what I was going to say, that now is the big, big move.
There you go.
Let's see. Whoa.
So like what's interesting is that what people don't know is that you have to have enough power to change three discs at once, which is instantaneous. Like, it's one of these technical challenges that seems like a big deal. Just change from 1159 to 12, but it's actually, it is a big deal. It's like incredibly hard to do that well, and to do that right, and to store the power to do it and the whole thing. So that's the kind of fun mechanical impressive stuff that I don't really understand, but I understand enough that inspires me. But more so it's that this brand did this thing in a way that had never been done before and that no one really expected them to do. I like that kind of thing.
So am I getting this right? Part of what you like about watches and the industry now is that they have this challenge of keep pushing it. And even though it's kind of getting closer to not max, but it's the last few bits that get improved, that sort of thing.
It's like, yeah, it's the, it's going a little bit extra, going a little bit over, you know? And watches are a great place for this because some brands finish their watches at such a high level, meaning they bevel every edge and it's all done by hand. And there's things that you'll never see that they do. They spend hours and countless hours on. And like, I just like the fact that that craft exists in today's world, especially that it's not seen as a waste of time. It's actually seen as an important thing.
I feel like you would like Formula One, or at least have you ever tried watching? Because that's kind of the same challenge. And even some watch companies have collaborations with Formula One teams where it's kind of like you'd think it's close to max performance, but then you need to push a bit more because every other team is doing. Have you ever tried watching, or are you into it?
Formula One, yeah. Formula One's incredibly impressive. It's a mind-blowing feat of engineering. It's like the pinnacle. I feel like the space program and then Formula One are like the two things that are like just at the absolute limits of human achievement in terms of mechanical, you know, creation or whatever, however you want to put it. So I don't follow it well enough to know like all the drivers and all the cars and all the brands. I've followed it enough to have a sense, but it's just thoroughly impressive and an incredible thing that humans can make machines that can do these things. Very, very amazing. It's really, really incredible. And then the sport, of course, is a whole other thing with competition and everything and attitudes and personalities, but the mechanics of it and the actual physical mechanical achievement is really mind-blowing.
I want to get to, if we have time, of course, get to cars a bit. But before that, do you mind if I ask you, sort of the same way you would ask a user about your product, I'm very curious, and I ask this to guests usually, what's in it for you in a podcast like this or in an AMA, just so that I know what to do more of? Like I guess it's a bit of a blunt question, but what's in it for you?
Why would I do it, you mean?
Yeah, or like, what do you get out of it? Or where's the value, just so that I know what's the value prop here, again, in an effort to maybe do more of it?
Yeah, for me, everything's a feeling. Like, I just felt like this would be fun to do. we talk a little bit about watches, talk about a little bit about tech, talk about maybe some car stuff. I don't think you mentioned the car stuff, but like, yeah, sounds kind of like a cool thing to do. I think you approached me in a way that didn't feel like a pressure or whatever. I don't know. It just, this one I said yes to. I don't really have a good answer. I mean, I've been saying no to a lot of them recently, mostly because I'm kind of tired of talking about the same stuff over and over at the moment. So I had a sense that these questions would be a bit different. And your interests were different. So it seemed like it would be an interesting thing to do. So I would, you know, if I was to give you advice there, I would, you know, research your subjects well and mention some things that are maybe not obvious to others that you would like to talk about. And I think you might, you know, attract more people who would be interested in talking to you versus someone else, if they know that they're gonna be able to talk about some of them, maybe their interests that are beyond just the obvious ones.
Speaking about cars, because I said we're going to get to cars if we have time, I really want to fit this in. I believe you like the 911. If you don't, I don't really understand how, because you've mentioned it a couple of times in your... how should I call a world that, hey, is it a blog? Is it a newsletter?
Yeah,
it's its own thing.
I don't know what to call it. It's just a personal publishing place. It's a good question, though. We should probably figure out a better name for it. Yeah.
I guess I'm just going to call it world that, hey. Because yeah. It's kind of like a blog, but I read it through email because I'm subscribed. So
yep.
Anyway, so Porsche 911, what do you like about it? What's so special about this car as a fellow 911 fan?
Well, I mean, starting at the basics, like it just they're beautiful objects. Like aesthetically, they speak to me. I like the shape. I've always liked the shape from the earliest one to the most recent one. They're just I like looking at them. They're very beautiful. Now, they're also really interesting because they shouldn't be as good as they are, which is also kind of another interesting little trait. Like the engine's in the wrong place, and there's really no other car that does it this way. And Porsche has been engineering, themselves out of that deficiency for going on almost 60 years now. And that this car has a lineage, consistency. It's very similar to the Rolex Submariner. The Submariner from, the late 50s basically looks like the one today. It's a constant evolution and improvement and not giving up on the idea and the ideal of the thing. Which is what we've tried to do with Basecamp. I mean, we're only at it now since 2004, so 17 years. But like this, the fundamental idea remains the same, and we're trying to constantly improve it every generation without losing sight of what it really is. And I think there's that. But aesthetically, the 911 just feels right every time I see one, especially the older ones. They're absolutely beautiful to me. And driving an older one, I just had an opportunity to drive a 1970 911, which is the first generation, of them. And it's just a blast to drive. They're really fun, light, neat things. They're timeless. They really are. And there's very few objects and mechanical things and products that have been built like that that still look great 50, 60 years later. There are some, but not many. And not as many in cars. I mean, the thing is with cars, like you look at brands like Ferrari or something, Ferrari might make a car for a while and then they don't make that car anymore. Like the 911 is a car that they've been making, Porsche's been making for almost 60 years. That's cool. I just think that's cool. Commitment and improvement and constant iteration. And I like that. Yeah, that's it. It's also the other thing, one other thing about it. It's extremely practical, which is really interesting about the 911. People think of them as sports cars, and they are, and everything. But like, it's actually a really practical car. There's some room in the back. You got two seats in the back. They're tight, but they're there. You've got room in the front. There's actually quite a bit of room in these cars. You can do a lot with them, and they're all purpose, and especially all-wheel drive versions. Like, you can take them anywhere and do anything anytime you want. They're pretty special things, pretty neat things. The other last thing about them
Ron.
is that everyone's always like, there's always these new cars that are branded the 911 killer. Like everyone's trying to kill it. Like Audi came out with the R8, and it's like this is the 911 killer, and everyone's trying to like no one ever kills the 911. The 911 is without peer. It is its own thing. It just is its own category, and that's also a really interesting notion that a product can be so good and so unique and so original that it can really carve out its own thing within a bigger sphere, but also in some ways be so insulated from competition. It's really kind of interesting.
I love that.
Yeah.
Fun fact, on the last one, on the last 911, you might know this, you might not, but they have the headlights, two vertical ones on the back
Yes, and
when
there's
you
nine on each
brake.
side, right?
And it's 11 in total with the two red ones. So it's 911. So it's that sort of thing where you say you didn't have to do it that way. But as a person doing product a bit here and there, you say, oh, look, that's a nice Easter egg for the people who care enough to count.
Totally.
What I like about the 911, besides what you said, I agree, and it's yeah, the proper Grand Tourer and all that. What I like about it is the fact that this design language is the same. You've touched upon this as well across time, and just like the Submariner, it's not the same car, but at the same time, it is the same lineage, and lineage is a very nice word. And I'm thinking, what are your thoughts on this? I'm thinking whether to breathe very lightly touch upon the Facebook algorithm thing, what we mentioned earlier. I'm thinking, is it a bit of do we see a bit of ourselves in this sort of thing? Where is the lineage? Because you take a human today, you take a human from 1,000 years ago or 100 years ago, we are a bit the same, a bit different, but a bit the same. Do we just see ourselves in that, and maybe that's why we like that? Because, okay, I don't have the data to prove that 99 out of 100 people like the 911, but most of my friends look at 911 and say, yeah, mate, that's a nice car. Like,
yeah,
that's design. Do you think we see ourselves in that with this design language?
I think there's something. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think there is an attraction to things that have a certain longevity to them. It's almost like it can't be a fluke if it's been that good for that long, or it's been around that long. I tend to really like businesses that have been around for a long time and products that have been around for a long time. They, by their very nature of existing for that long, there's a different quality about them, which is that they're not flukes. They've lived through a few trends. They've lived through a few bubbles and bounces and collapses, and they're still here. There's something about that that means that there's something good here. The 911 had its, you know, there was some generations that were not as liked as others. You know, some people didn't like the 993 or the 996 or the 997 or whatever. Like, it kind of ebbs and flows, but it's still here and it's stronger than it's ever been right now, I think. And the other cool thing about it is that the 911 actually lives on in other models too. The Macan, like, is clearly styled based on some of the fundamental characteristics of the 911. And they tried to kill the 911. They were going to kill the 911 and replace it with the 928 in the late 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And the 911 just, the 928 was designed to replace the 911, and it just wouldn't die. I mean, part of that was because of some really diehards inside the company who wouldn't let it die, but like, it didn't die, it sticks around. And so there's the resilience there too, which I think people like, even if they don't know the story, they know this thing's been around. And that just proves something. It just proves something. Doesn't mean it's great, but it certainly means it's not terrible, because if it was, it would have been pushed away and cleared away. And there's something else there that's worth a second look.
And is your appreciation for the 911 coming from I like cars, or is it just the design product? Like, do you like cars generally outside this?
I do. I do like cars, although I've been gone through phases. but I do like, in general, I like cars, yes.
What phase are you in now?
What phase am I in now? I like electric cars now. But I also like old stuff. I don't know. I'm getting back into cars. For a while, I was sort of like, they're kind of a hassle. I don't really want one. I want one. I need one because where I live, I need a car to get around. But like, I don't really want two or whatever. I want one. And now I'm sort of getting back into them a little bit, but more actually, it's interesting. I'm getting into the old stuff and then the electric new stuff. So I'm not into modern internal combustion engine cars. I'm into modern electric cars and then old cars.
Do you share what you drive, or is that something personal?
I drive a Porsche Taycan.
Oh, I was going to say, when you mentioned electric, I was thinking, what do you think of the Taycan? So now I know what you think.
I love it. Taycan's the best car I've ever owned.
Really?
It's exceptionally good. Just incredibly good. In some ways it doesn't even feel like a car. It actually feels like a different thing. It's that good. So I love it. And I think the styling is beautiful. I think they really did a great job, and I'm really eager to see where it goes. I'm also, really curious. I don't own one, but I'm really curious about the Audi e-tron GT, which is sort of the Audi's version of that. I also, you know, the thing is, I've always wanted an Audi RS6, like the Avant, for forever. And they just finally came to the US, and I don't want one now because I don't want to buy a modern gas car. But I waited for that car for like 15 years, and now it's here, and I just don't want it. So that's kind of an example of me like kind of being over certain things, but then being into other things. So anyway, I don't know. I kind of go back and forth.
I'm surprised you said of the Taycan that is the best. I'm just assuming now, you ever driven a Tesla or had one?
We used to have a Model X. We don't have it anymore, but we used to have one.
So tell me this, how does, because on paper, just like the same old discussion about Android versus iPhone, on paper, the Tesla is beating it on every dimension, but you said the Taycan is the best car you've ever had or the most something, something.
Teslas are incredible. Teslas are incredible things. They're just, to me, they're more utilities than they are cars. That's how I feel about them when I get into them. It's basically a big screen and a pedal and a steering wheel. And Taycan feels to me like a car that was built by someone who likes to build cars. Tesla feels like, and nothing I'll take away, Tesla is literally an incredible thing what they've done, push the industry forward, and they make amazing products. But it doesn't feel like something built by people who love cars, which is fine, but totally fine, obviously fine. I would recommend a Tesla to everybody I know. They're excellent things, but for whatever reason, I just like the way the Taycan looks. I like the way it feels. I like the way it handles. I like the interior a whole lot better. It's more car-like and less computer-like. I've never judged things. I don't judge things on paper. You know, it's like, who cares what the figures are? None of that matters. It's how does it feel? What does it feel to you? Do you enjoy sitting inside the thing? Do you enjoy driving the thing? Do you enjoy being in the space of the thing? That's how I would look at these things.
Talking about feeling, the diehard fans of not trusting the feeling are saying you can't just do that because then, you need to be rational, this and that. Did you ever have, as a person who mentioned this a couple of times, of I do stuff based on how it feels, did you have any, not bad experience, but anything to lose by guiding yourself on the feeling and not on the, okay, let me put everything on paper and then see, and then this and then that.
I've never really been a data-driven person. I don't like to make decisions that way. It's not that, maybe my decisions could be better if they were more data-driven and more rational in those ways. But I think you can make rational decisions without like pulling up a spreadsheet. You know, you can evaluate risk and all sorts of things. But I just personally enjoy I prefer betting on ideas and people and things. And you inform your bet as best you can. And sometimes there's data involved, you know, here and there on the edges, but I'd rather just follow my intuition and see where it takes me. I'm not somebody who needs to maximize or optimize everything. So like, could a database decision in whatever case like lead to a better outcome by 9% or something? Yeah, probably could. I don't necessarily care about that personally. I have nothing against people who do. And if other people are making decisions and they're more based on data and that's what they choose to do, that's fine. I would support that. I'm just like trying to be true to myself and the kind of decisions I like to make. Are more based on feel and gut and intuition. And they've served me pretty well. So I just continued to do it that way. It's not that I dismiss that approach at all. Purely rational approach or database approach is probably a really smart approach for a whole lot of things too. They're just different angles.
Which makes me think about the concept of JOMO. For anybody listening who might not know this, is the joy of missing out, not FOMO, the fear of missing out. Which help me understand, if you will. I've heard about it from you. I don't know if you've invented it or not, but I've heard it from you. And I said, "Oh, JOMO, nice. I'll try that next time." And then I got into a situation where I said, "Oh, this is the part where it's meant to feel good, but it doesn't. Fuck, JOMO. I'm not getting this." So. Probably the situation goes deeper and it's, you know, within me and all that. Where does this come from, this joy of missing out? Or maybe the question is from the other angle of what makes somebody not have fear of missing out?
What makes someone not have it?
It seems like by default it is in people, or not by default, but
yeah, I think
statistically speaking.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I don't miss the things I don't have or I don't know about.
Have you ever noticed? Because when you look at, sometimes you can see in somebody the steps preliminary to a certain behavior. For instance, you can see somebody getting really stressed and overthinking something before it happened. And you might tell them friendly, look, it didn't happen yet, so no point in stressing over that.
Yeah.
Did you see something like that in people when it comes to the fear of missing out of, oh, I'm not going to have it, or, oh, I'm going to miss the 5%? Or was it more of an internal journey? I know you gave that example of the mile that you ran and you didn't run up, but you were a few seconds off and you said, yeah, why would I not?
Who cares?
Yeah, yeah, who cares? Why would I not enjoy that? It's still the same thing almost.
There must be a real human degree of like wanting to be in the loop, you know, a fundamental instinct to like want to know what the tribe cares about, what the tribe needs to know, you know. So I can understand again where that comes from. It's just not something that I've ever really, it's never really affected me. I don't know why. I'm just feel like the things that I'm paying attention to are enough things for me to think about and pay attention to versus also having to worry about the things I'm not paying attention to. Or like, I think for example, like I don't watch any TV or any shows, you know, anything on Netflix. So like, I could not participate in a lot of conversations that, you know, friends might be having around the dinner table or around, you know, hanging out or something at a restaurant, talking about pop culture or something. And like, I don't know. And I don't care to know. Some people they'll feel like they need to be up on that so they can be part of the conversation. I just don't really, I'd rather just not join the conversation and just listen. I'd rather just listen, go ahead. You know, I don't watch these shows, but I'd like, you know, I'm curious to hear what you have to say about them. I just don't feel like I need to have an opinion on everything. That maybe that's part of it. I don't feel like I owe an opinion about everything, nor do I feel like I need to have an opinion about everything. And I don't mind not having an opinion, or I don't mind not knowing. So I don't know if that's all related or not, but I haven't really thought about it. But since you brought it up, it's what comes to mind.
Well, what strikes me now that you tell me that you're not thinking about it this way is, and I'll conclude for myself and for the listeners, with the risk of being wrong, I'll conclude that maybe the thing to do, quote unquote, is to not do anything in the sense of not thinking about it. Because that's what I hear from you reading between the lines. You just don't think about it in the sense of, and it makes sense because overthinking means you keep going down that rabbit hole of a negative possible thing. So I'll take that from you.
Just leave it at that. I don't really know. It's a good question though. It doesn't bother me not to know. That's all. I don't know how else to say it.
No, that's fine. I think that it's an answer within itself, you know.
Yeah.
I
got about 5 minutes, just give you a heads
that's
up.
That's fine.
Okay.
If I would imagine myself talking to the Buddha or whatever religion, yeah, I don't think they will have an answer that makes sense, because it doesn't have to make sense to a degree, like to the thinking mind.
A good friend of mine, his default response on everything is like, I don't know. I just don't know. Like, I don't have an opinion. Actually, I have thoughts and ideas, but it's actually not an opinion. Opinion is something that's kind of formed. And I really admire that about him. This is not quite the same as FOMO, JOMO, kind of whatever, but like, I really admire this. Like, I actually don't have an opinion on most things. I have some ideas about them, but I don't feel like they're not like Lego bricks clicking together and creating something. They're all separate things. And I don't have a perspective on it. I realize that I don't know most things. And I'm sort of okay with that. And I admire that about him. And I've been trying to be a little bit more that way myself, actually.
Cool. So to conclude, one last question I'll be curious to hear from you is, if you were younger, I would ask you, who'd you look up to? But I get this sense that people, as they grow in life, they don't really look up to people. But I'll phrase it like that with this huge intro, with the other side of the question of who inspires you, who gives you energy, or in this period of life or lately?
Yeah. I think anyone who's, I like individuals. I like characters. I like people who are unique and interesting and do things that are unabashedly them. This other guy I met recently, he's a chiropractor. And I met him because he's a chiropractor and my neck was all messed up. And so a friend of mine recommended I get some work with him and he helped me. And we kind of hit it off. We started talking about watches, actually. We started talking about some other stuff and then I went over to his place to check out some stuff that he had. And you go to his house and he's just got an interesting life. He's got a bunch of old stuff he's restoring. He's built this huge stone wall himself. He has this extremely rare collection of plants, like really, really interesting plants from around the world. He's just like, he knows what he likes. He's an eclectic mix of a lot of different things and he's a true individual. And I just like that. I respect that. I'm inspired by that. I want to be more like that myself. That's the kind of person thing that just kind of gets me excited these days. Are people who are really unique individuals. Because it's very hard to be that these days. There's a lot of pseudo individuality where people are sort of actually mimicking somebody else and trying to be like an individual, like someone else, but that's not really a true individual. I think like people who are really on their own wavelength and doing their own thing, their own way really impress me. So I think those are the kinds of people. And then also there's like companies, you can extend that to companies, like companies that really know themselves really well, that really do things that are 100% them. And then there's all sorts of other things, like I'm inspired by nature and whatnot. But if we get back to just people and things, like it's the original unique people and original unique things and brands that really know who they are and aren't afraid of that. I like that a lot.
I love that answer. And yeah. I kind of expected an answer like that, an answer like Steve Jobs and this CEO from this company would have been a bit boring because everybody says that, and I guess you could just put them all together. And anyway, I'm going to stop the recording soon. Thanks very much for coming in here. I'm glad we didn't talk that much about SaaS as I thought we will, because you said at one point that I keep saying the same shit all over again. Anyways, minus the cussing. And I know because I've listened to them. So I try to do that with my guests, try to bring out stuff that wasn't mentioned on the podcast. This podcast is really for those like me who go down the rabbit hole of somebody. So I'm trying to bring answers that weren't put up before.
Cool. We did a great job. I thought the questions were wonderful. Thank you.
I appreciate it. I'm going to stop the recording now. I usually ask people where should the listeners reach you, but I feel like they can already find that. Hey.com and Basecamp.com?
Yeah, hey.com, Basecamp.com, and you can link up my Hey World newsletter as well, or whatever you call that. So yeah.
That's the central point now.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Anytime. Thank you.